podcast is brought to you by Wildflower Zen Sangha. This Dharma talk was given by Joa Setbong.
So, hello everyone. Last Thursday, I had a conversation with Roshi and she asked me if I wanted to do the talk that night. And for the first time, I declined the kind offer. And then the following day, I felt very guilty. I declined it because I had no idea what to say. And I was also very exhausted. And I think I was trapped in the desire to say something meaningful, useful. And I didn't have any idea. And I could have said, okay, yes, I'll see what comes up at that moment in a couple of hours, but I didn't. And I didn't prepare anything today. I didn't really have a particular topic in mind. But there was one word that kept coming back, I think over the past maybe 2 days, 3 days. Not a word, actually, an expression that kept coming back in my mind. And that expression is meeting the impersonal. Meeting the impersonal. There are many different strings, that different threads of thoughts that kind of led me to that expression. One kind of fundamental question was, what do we do when we sit? What exactly do we do? And over the past few days, I was kind of immersed in the work of Dogen Zenji, and he was insisting on the fact that we don't sit to awaken. And I had to stop for a second and check with my experience how that felt. Because I keep thinking that it's a training. We train the mind. We have certain practices, formal practices. One of these core practice is sitting, silent meditation, Zazen. Why do we do that? in introductions, I keep saying, you know, drop any even ideas of results, of goals. And yet there's that notion of awakening, that desire to awaken, and that desire to awaken being cultivated by the sitting practice, among other things. So what's happening there? I was going back to that. Going back to the task of what we do in meditation, to quiet down, to experience a space of non-reactivity, to dwell in a space that is different from where we usually dwell in. And so the answer of Dogen Zenji is we sit because we awaken. So how does that work? How does that work? When we practice that, when we sit in silence, when we quiet down, when we dwell in a non-reactive space, that is the awakened space. That is what is actually happening. But what is really happening by doing that? And this is how this expression that went through my mind, we meet the impersonal. And I was, as we sat, I was remembering this famous quote that we keep mentioned quoting from Dogen about the self, to study the way, to study the way is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self. And I thought maybe to forget the self, because sometimes all we say, you know, drop the self, and maybe another way to phrase it could be to meet the impersonal, to merge with a moment when it's not about me. The experience that we can have in meditation about at a certain moment, we focus on our breath or we focus on our koan, and it's not even I focus on the breathing. That's something about the I kind of disintegrate. And this is not a mystical experience in the sense that we're not entering in a way in a higher type of consciousness. So it's a very also ordinary, extremely ordinary experience of when the I is not involved in the conversation that we have with ourselves or with others when it's not involved. And I've been reflecting a lot over the past weeks about the meaning of the different flavor that we have in the Chinese texts compared to ancient Indian texts, and why these koan stories or the poetry that are linked to all these koans talk about the world and describe the natural world, that is, or the natural surroundings. And I think it tries to convey that experience where when we are in the midst of all that, that we meet something about the impersonal. It's not about me. It's not even my interaction with the world. Or with this koans where the teacher ends up screaming or hitting the student. At that precise moment, it's very impersonal. When we are surprised by something, that moment where it actually happened, this is very impersonal. It's not about me anymore. It's not about I'm being afraid. This is how we reconstruct what happens afterwards, how we can talk about it. But really what really happened at that moment is very impersonal. And a lot of the devices that we have in the Zen training, in our Zen training, in retreats, unfortunately, we can only experience part of it right now. But the rituals, for example, the orioki, the eating together, the way we formalize things, are another way to meet the impersonal, to have that experience where it's just not about me. Well, it's not just about me. This is not about me. This is not a story that goes on. Can we just do things? Can we just eat the rice, do the movements, do the gesture? Just do it, simply do it. I have an impersonal experience of that. So, as most of you know, I'm sewing the kesa right now, and this is another experience of sometimes meeting the impersonal. And sometimes I meet the personal. I was very pleased with what I did at first, and then I went to Montreuil, someone said, not right, you have to unsew, put the pieces together again, apart, and bring it back together, sew again. Frustration and kind of sense of despair sometimes. That was very personal. And then when I get into the mood of it, there are certain even rituals where I could, even sing things. And that's also another way to reach the impersonal. And the flavor that comes from that, from f- from acting from that place is very different, feels very different. So the doing it is actually that state of dwelling in non-reactivity. That's another way to put it. Is the Buddha way, is the awakened way. And linked to that, I kept coming back to an interaction that took place last weekend. We had with Roshi, we had a teacher's meeting. And someone in the group asked the more senior teachers how we dealt with, he's a Dharma holder, and he was asking how senior kind of the teachers were handling the professional life and the practice. And, you know, as I was in the middle of my Dogen studies, Dogen emphasized a lot the formal practice, Zazen, just like he was like a hardcore practitioner. He had a whole community of monks that were really, really, really just meditating really, really hard. And it seemed for him, it seemed extremely essential, crucial, fundamental to this path. Witnessing that, I was asking myself, so, you know, how do we do it in our world? We can't do that. I personally can't sit 6 months of a year of during the years for 6 months in the Zendo. It's just impossible. I don't have the time. It just doesn't work. So how do we sustain that? So that was a very legitimate question. How do we meet the impersonal? How do we train? How do we live by that meeting the impersonal in our daily life, when we can't sit formally, or we can't do orioki at every meal, or we can't do services or whatever. So I think that's, you know, our lay practice. It's a challenge for our lay practice. But it's only a challenge, I feel, if we make a distinction between our formal practice and all the other non-formal practices. This is what we do with the Heart of Life retreat and all the day of practices that we had online, where we try to integrate in the other part of the day that quality. And for myself, I feel that I need to invent also tricks or devices, rituals, personal rituals that bring me back to, that help me to get back into that mood, into that non-personal space. Can take the form of simply, for example, I'm interacting with someone, I speak with someone. There's an argument starting. Can I let the person finish? Can I swallow that thought? Can I even like restate what the person is saying to me? Can I say, okay, can I just stop for 2 seconds before I jump in? A moment where it becomes less personal. I notice also when, if I take the car and about to go somewhere and my automatic behaviors, like putting the radio on, what's happening there? What's the story behind? Do I want this? Can I just, and decide from there. I like also what Bernie did, Bernie Glassman, setting up his alarm at midday every day. And for 2 seconds, you stop whatever you're doing, come back. Just, what am I doing? What's happening? Anything that makes us stop that kind of automatic process that is going on in our life, that allows us to step back and to drop something about our little personal story that goes on at that moment. And certainly meditation is a core device, a core training, and also the experience itself of meeting the impersonal. Yeah, it makes me think that the kind of one of the core term in this tradition, the awakening Bodhi, has in a way kind of two sense that also is very much linked to, it has the sense of we awaken from and we awaken to. We wake up from uh, I don't know how to say that in English. A form of sleepiness, I guess we could say. And we awaken to, that opens up. We awaken to. Life, you know, we much greater capacity to embrace life, to embrace everything that comes up, because that personal story has been dropped. And just, I think I'd like to open that the discussion to the what are the outside formal practice? What are the things that are, do you have things that you set up for yourself that brings you back to that impersonal space, to that present moment? Are they things that, you know, moments where, that we encounter that helps us to come back to that, step out from our personal stories, see the bigger picture, embrace something larger than ourselves. And I have a tendency to think that actually most of the time we are not caught up. But most of the time, are we fully aware of what is happening? So, with us, within us. So, that can be a subject of sharing. So, we would be interested to hear what are your tricks, if you have any tricks. Or any experience of being lost and awakened from something, being awakened to something. Yeah, Sue?
Can you better explain what you mean with meeting the impersonal?
So, if I can take this particular example of rituals when we are in the Zendo, how we enter the Zendo, how we walk around the Zendo, how we go to our seat and bow to our seat, and then turn and bow to the person facing us. At that moment, you know, you might enter and not know the rules, not know how to do it. Christine was mentioning that the other time. If you know, you might have very strong opinions. I don't want to do it. This is silly. I can't stand it. And what's this whole thing about bowing and bowing? I mean, come on, bowing. And then people keep bowing, and it's really annoying and I don't want to do it. And this is all a question of being submitted. And then we go on. And that's very interesting to notice. That's kind of the first, well, the first stage would be even to be aware that something is going on. You can move around and nobody tells you what to do and you don't even realize that there are certain rules. But then once you realize, you can have an opinion about it. And that is very personal, right? And then suddenly, I mean, it grows and then you understand. And then maybe at some point you might think, oh, I really love rituals and I really love that. And that really makes sense. And that's perfect and all that. That's, again, that's very personal. But if we just surrender to that and we just fully do it,
okay,
it becomes very impersonal. Right? It's like, when does the little personal story, the story that is going on in my head, when it's about me thinking this and me thinking that, and we keep going on with that little story.
Like the meaning of embodied.
The meaning what?
Embodied.
The meaning is embodied? That's what you
mean? Like, it means for me, what you explain, it's it means also the feeling I have when I say embodied.
Okay.
It's that? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, when it is fully embodied, and there's, again, when it's fully embodied, then the personal gets out of the way. And this is, in the koan practice, this is what is very much involved. Can we just embody something without being involved with our own personal stories and preferences? And you can read the koans, also the response. This is why I was saying the response being very impersonal. And it's just like all these moments during the day when we just do the things we do just directly without being trapped in a whole, you know, like me with my kesa being, oh my God, I have to do it again. And this is terrible. And I wish it was different and all that. You know, that is very personal. Impersonal embodiment is just doing it. Just doing it, just sewing, just point by point, step by step.
Okay, thank you.
Right? Yeah, Lisa?
Hi, good evening. I was gonna use a similar example of which most of you've heard, and I think it's sort of it works in with what you're saying is for the Rakusu and Jukai. For me, it's if I become personal about it, I don't do it. I am doing it and I'm just doing it, because if I start putting stuff myself into it, then it's just, I just draw back. So yeah, otherwise I don't have tips. And sometimes I wish I had, I guess. But often I like you're saying, see the see the patterns, see yourself, like just that, that's starting again. And well, I'm at the stage where I just see it and it just like,
I don't know if it's just me, but it froze a little bit with you. Okay.
I am. My connection isn't this time of night, of the evening, it never works very well. Sorry.
I think one important, very important piece of the puzzle I find is that this non-reactive, how do we recognize kind of a negative reactivity? And I think it has to do with kind of, I'm picking up on what you said, just something that is becoming repetitive also. Sometimes reaction is really good, like in moments where sometimes it can save our life to have, you know, just to respond in a very reactive way. But when does it become repetitive and we kind of, when it's being stabilized in a repetition, that is becoming an addiction. So if we step back and we see, we train ourselves to dwell in this non-reactive space, something is really being transformed. And I think, Lisa, what I assume also you, but by doing it, by just doing it, something is, you feel the quality of the difference of something, no, something larger is happening for you. Yes? Yeah. and that's, I would phrase it like there you meet the impersonal and it becomes larger. And in fact, the what Dogen says is, yeah, to study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by mirrored things. And when actualized by mirrored things, your body and mind, as well as the body and mind of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. There's something vast in it, precisely because it's impersonal. There's something that then has to do with compassion, a relational perspective on things, because it's not about me. It's not about my own story. So I feel it roots very much a possibility of empathy is also rooted very much in the impersonal. It's 30 degrees in my office. It's really hot. Yeah, Juan.
Good evening, everyone. It's It's not exactly a trick, but I've been noticing lately that I am very much aware of, and you talked about this sometimes, how it something there's something in the body. There's a some kind of feeling in the body. It can it's different things, probably related to different things as well. I haven't quite checked it in that way. And I've been noticing how I am more aware to that. Sometimes that's like the first many times that's like the something's happening. What is it? How am I right now? So it's like it sometimes it feels like the body notices it first. It reaches the body first, or so it doesn't reach it. The body knows it first, or something.
So. Yeah, I can totally relate to that, and I feel it gives a cue, it gives a signal for me that I find very interesting to look at. You know, someone says something and that you dislike and you run to respond, and it's not even the conceptual thing that is happening first. There's really that, for me, that sense of someone says something that triggers a reaction, and the reaction is really that you can really feel it in the body. And I found this is one of the tricks that we can use to like, okay, what is happening? Let's look at it. How many times have we all heard probably from Roshi, just stay with it. You know, we hear something, we feel something, we have something that keeps coming back, you know, stay with it. If we just stay with it without trying to avoid it, without trying to put it on the side, without trying to suppress it, embracing it, but from a non-reactive space. And that is how it can be also transformed and turn into an impersonal thing. Yeah, Christine?
Yeah, that's just something that reminds me of what I heard about the different brains we have, that the emotional brain is very fast and reactive. So if we're in a situation where we want to respond, that's the quickest thing that happens, that we go into the emotions and blah. And what we can do to get this extra second to maybe have a more mindful answer is to feel in our bodies what's the sensation, and this already quiets down a little bit this emotional brain, the limbic brain, and then later on what goes on in the head can analyze or whatever. But it's having a feeling of what is going on is already a good one step forward towards more awareness. And I heard something else that someone said, that there was a study who showed that 93% of what we think is just automatic, autopilot, where we don't have any influence on it. And only 7% left that we can actually
consciously choose. But I nevertheless have the, I dare to believe that with meditation we can shift this percentage a little bit more to the, I don't know what's your experience with that, but I, since I meditate, I think I'm much more aware of already what is going on, that it's not just going on without you even realizing what's going on.
Yeah, I've been very puzzled by this article that I read also in that was going into that direction, saying that most of it, most of our behavioral answers are automatic and we can't change anything. So I've been very puzzled by that, and I know nothing about neuroscience, so I would be very interested to look more into it. I can only testify that we maybe it's just the 1%, but it does, you know, like a mindful life feels have a different flavor. So I don't know which percentage I managed to work on, but it does feel different. It does. So, find the that's one of the things I do also in meditation sometimes in the beginning, to ask oneself, how does that feel? How does it feel in the body? How do I feel in my body? You know, do I have any tensions? And go over, like doing what they do in Vipassana, you know, doing a body scan. And but also I find sometimes it's useful to do that, to have clues of what might be going on that we are not even fully aware consciously. And yeah, the body can give us clues on that. That we're trapped in a reactive, repetitive pattern, and we're not fully aware. And yet the body is telling us that something is wrong. So I found that very useful.
I'm sorry. I just thought about when my kids were still smaller, I was singing every night some little songs and before when they were in bed. And that was always my moment of really being aware and, you know, noticing, well, another day has gone by and they are growing up. And from just singing some small words and not even knowing how to spell them, they became, well, sometimes they could sing one phrase or then they stopped singing with me and just listened. And but it was always a moment that I was really aware. And now I think, wow, that was 365 times a year and for several years, and now I don't do it anymore because they are too big. So they don't want any songs anymore. Sometimes we still do it because they still like it. But yeah, it's just, no, the youngest is 8. So no more need for a good night song. But that's, yeah, that was a nice thing to do really with full awareness. So. Time swiftly passes by.
Yeah, and the singing is, you know, when we sing the sutras or whatever we're singing, the morning chants, the vows and all that.
Yeah, and it's always the same song, so you don't have to, it was, some, I know, it was a similar experience, I think, than what we do in the Sendo.
But it's also possible. I remember, I think it's this week, I was dealing with the bells, and I think it's Juan who was leading the chant. And I don't know, he did his thing, and I don't even know where I was in my mind, but I was probably in my personal stories, and I completely lost track where he was. And then at the end of it, it was finished. I hadn't even do on the third time. And because on the second, I was like, is it the first or the second? I wasn't paying attention. I don't know where I was. And and so I thought, well, you know, I'll hear it. And
that happens. That happens to me too, but I don't do the bell, so you don't realize it.
So these are moments where you notice that you're not fully present, and you're tripped. And that happens all the time. And on the other hand, that also can be a moment where we fully experience the impersonal by just fully singing it and not being involved in, while singing, thinking of something else that, strangely enough, we're still able to do. Especially when we know these chants by heart so well that it's just like, you can do it and at the same time think of what you're going to do next and the food that is going to be being prepared and all kinds of stories that we can have. Yeah. But it's a flavor. I keep coming back to that. It's just like it gives a flavor, a different flavor to life. Nobody forces us to do anything. We can continue indulging in our repetitive, destructive patterns, or we can try to cultivate the spirit of the awakening, the bodhicitta. And and just, you know, doing fully what we do, single-mindedly. And that is very ordinary. So that goes back to, you know, this poetry that the Zen masters left us, that are very just ordinary, trying to express that ordinariness and directness, just what's there. All right, we are reaching the end of the evening. Well, thank you for listening and sharing.
If you have enjoyed this Dharma talk, just give us a visit on wildflowerzen.org.